We have done many programs with Dr. Nick Begich on this intriguing technology called HARP, which is an ionospheric heater, this incredible thing up in Alaska that points at the ionosphere and is capable of burning a hole right through it with intensely focused RF energy, or many, many other things, bouncing it off the ionosphere, perhaps confusing troops on the ground, all kinds of things. We've done that show over the years. We will touch on many other things tonight than that. However, welcome to the program, Dr. Begich.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be with you again. It's been a while, and we're just glad to be on the air again and talking about these very important topics.
They are important topics. And before we move on to, we've got a lot more to do tonight. I see that you've really broadened out what you're able to talk about and what you're investigating. But I would like to get the latest on HARP. Since we last spoke, Doctor, what has been going on with HARP?
Well, you know, HARP has changed hands a little bit. I think the last time we were on, it was still being run by the Air Force and Navy. DARPA now has control of the project. Which really drops it down a little bit in terms of how they classify material. DARPA is a defense research agency, and they basically look at the implications of technologies that maybe have things that are considered black, or those things that are hidden from public view. You know, HARP also has changed hands, you know, in terms of the patent record over the years. I have stayed in contact with the inventor, Dr. Bernard Eastland, and he has continued to do work in one particular area associated with HARP, and that's weather modification. And he did a follow-on report for the European Space Agency to use HARP-type arrays, these field of antennas, for weather modification. He then went on to do another study for, interestingly enough, a joint study for NASA and FEMA, utilizing the same ideas but a space-based technology using high-powered lasers for weather modification. And then in 2005, he delivered a paper at the University of Pennsylvania where he had actually started to look at the use of something much different, using gravitational and acoustic waves for weather modification. And what he found is that he could do this with 1,600 times less energy than what he originally thought was necessary when HARP was first conceived. So, you know, in that particular vein, I know Dr. Eastland has continued to move in that direction. The one change is he is not delivering that technology to the government. He feels like weather modification is such a controversial issue that it really belongs in the public. It's something that shouldn't be hidden. Basically, if we're going to do it, we need to do it much differently than we have in the past. And I think HARP, as a system, what we see is a lot more integration and cooperation between countries. As you know, we opposed it in the European Parliament years ago and actually had a resolution passed in the European Parliament where HARP was, in fact, looked at as a technology that ought to be significantly restricted because of its environmental potential and consequences.
Okay. Let's back up a little bit. And we'll certainly get to the weather modification, Dr. Eastland, but you said the patent has changed and that DARPA is now running HARP. Now, that has some pretty ominous implications in my mind. What? Obviously, it's gone dark. It's gone black. So we probably don't know, but, Doctor, if you were to guess what DARPA's intent now for HARP is, what would you guess?
Well, I would go back to their own literature, and I would say that they intend to fully implement the absolute capabilities, which deal a lot more with interference and with communications, with ground-penetrating tomography, or this idea in the vernacular, or by analogy, would be like X-raying the Earth or looking into the Earth. In fact, that showed up on November 27th in an MSNBC report, right after the 9/11 incident, where they were going to use HARP technology to go over and locate all the underground facilities. We never heard what became of that. But as you start to look into HARP and you realize that beyond all of the straight-up military applications that are in the open record, there are these other areas, geophysical manipulation, the idea of changing components of the environment for weapons applications. In other words, to be able to Think about weather warfare or the generation of earthquakes or volcanic eruptions using electromagnetic waves, something that most people think is strictly impossible. Actually, you can go back to the language of the Secretary of Defense, William Cohen, and he was commenting on various weapons and their capabilities, and he talked about these very same technologies. And what he said in a DOD press briefing, and I quote, others are engaging even in an eco-type of terrorism whereby they can alter climate, set off earthquakes and volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves. This is the stuff that HAARP could indeed do. When we looked at later reports, there was an Army report where they were really looking at this technology primarily to control a battle environment or to even wage war without anybody knowing it. I mean, now we have preemptive warfare. We also have the capability of waging it in a way where the environment becomes the weapon.
Do you believe that we have actually reached that point with that DARPA has now reached that point with that capability?
Absolutely. I firmly believe it. I think the evidence expresses it. You know, from the time we, Gene Manning and I, wrote the book Angels Don't Play This Harp, we produced, I produced a follow-on series with my co-author Jim Roderick, Earth Rising the Revolution, Earth Rising 2, both of which we continue to follow technology trends, not just HAARP, but the diversity of trends. And, you know, one of the things that I think is the most revealing is sort of the convergence of technologies. As we see these technologies advance, they're no longer advancing sort of in isolation. Because of the distribution of information and the data flow, we're seeing convergences of technology where even more powerful systems, for instance, with HAARP, when you connect HAARP with the capability of supercomputers, when you combine HAARP with the latest information on biophysics, the effect of electromagnetic energy on living systems, then you start to get into some areas that become very alarming. In fact, the latest book that we've just released in August was Controlling the Human Mind, Technologies of Political Control. And HAARP does play a part in that, in the sense that it has the ability to modulate the electromagnetic field lines of the planet in such a way as to deliver on what Dr. Persinger at Laurentian University proposed in one of his papers, which was if we could figure out how to modulate the magnetic fields of the Earth, we could manipulate behavior over huge geographic areas.
This is all right. Well, you and I both know, Doctor, that they're not going to get to a specific battlefield application, for example, until they've damn well tested this. Now, what I'm about to say is a reach out into the fringe, but that's what I do on this program, is reach to the fringe. There have been, I have noted, I said it the other day, it's almost as though some evil has begun propagating, much the way radio waves, I said, and television waves have propagated. Now, HAARP indeed propagates in exactly that way. Now, is there any possibility that they've been testing HAARP and affecting human beings, not just in North America, but perhaps even around the world? We know that there's a history of our government willing to test on its own people or others.
That's right.
Could this have been going on, Doctor?
Absolutely. In fact, it was Secretary of Energy O'Leary that admitted under the Clinton administration that 500,000 Americans had been victims of human experimentation without their consent.
Exactly.
You know, when you think about these systems, yes, absolutely, I believe they would be applied. When you go back even as far as 1969, the work of J.F. Gordon MacDonald, a geophysicist and advisor to President Lyndon Johnson, suggested that these technologies would evolve. And, you know, it was Lyndon Johnson that was getting biweekly reports on, for instance, wiretapping and monitoring of all the congressional offices during the Vietnam War. You know, the idea of surveillance technologies and using technologies to gain political advantage has been the subject of many writers, including Zbigniew Brzezinski while he was at Columbia University. In the book Between Two Ages, he actually suggests that we would one day develop systems that would be able to manipulate behavior over huge geographic areas by being able to electronically stroke the ionosphere in just the right way to return a signal to the Earth. And what that book also said is that all these technologies, as they evolved, would be used, no matter who was in power, liberal or conservatives, to further their political ends, on the idea that they were doing good. I mean, in their minds, they're doing good. In everyone else's minds, manipulating other people's behavior, I think most of us would find highly objectionable.
I should say. So, you know, we read these horrible headlines every day of people committing crimes that seem to have no motive whatsoever except to propagate as much death as an individual can propagate before either taking their own life or having the police take their life. And you just shake your head at them. There just can't be a reason for this other than just sort of evil propagating. And so I know it's a long reach to say, could HARP be doing this? But could HARP be doing this? And I guess the answer is yeah.
Yeah, it could be. You know, and it's not such a long reach. And I'll tell you what we found in our work. Well, we were looking at all of the different ways in which human behavior can be altered and mitigated. I found over 300 source documents that we actually used, and these are primarily academic studies, government reports, U.S. patents, military documents that are non-classified. And as we compiled the material and took a look at it, you know, in terms of that specific instance where you get this sort of lone person that just acts out in a totally bizarre way,
yes.
We were asked over the years about those instances, and until I really got into this research the last couple of years, we pinned down a whole history that traces it through a very interesting character by the name of George Estabrooks. George Estabrooks worked initially in the Harvard labs back in the 20s studying hypnosis, and that's where he kind of started, and he believed that you could actually create what he said was the super spy by taking a person into a very deep state of hypnosis and deliberately fracturing the personality, where one side of his personality would know everything about the other, and the other would be basically dumb. It would just know what it was programmed, and they could send this person out to do various things. He developed a whole method of creating this type of personality split, and by 1935, his work was classified. I went and pulled the record from the Library of Congress on everything the guy wrote and was able to find three of his books, one 1943, revised in 1957, a book called Hypnotism. The next one, interestingly enough, by the title of Spiritism, 1947, dealing with mediums and trance mediums. And then the third book, and the most important book, was The Future of the Human Mind, written in 1961, where he discussed many of the things within the context of that book later came out in the MK Ultra, which was the mind control programs of the CIA that were revealed in the early 70s. Use of LSD as an example, Estabrooks believed therapeutically you could use this in some reasonable way. And, of course, today we look back on that and we all kind of laugh about it because it's sort of ridiculous that we would have pursued this. And yet our government, according to one June 1975 report to the president on the Commission of CIA Activities in the United States, showed that 8,000 servicemen and women have been given LSD just to see how we could manipulate behavior.
Yeah. Doctor, when essentially did HARP bring the black cloak of secrecy down over HARP?
Well, I think we kind of triggered a lot of it. I mean, there was a lot of it that was classified from the very beginning. And as we got vocal about this, in fact, I was thinking, you know, it was 10 years ago that you and I did the first broadcast on this subject. And
that's right. And at that time, HARP was supposedly an open scientific endeavor. It was just talk to us, interview us, whatever, it doesn't matter, it's all open.
They'd never show up on the radio.
Yeah, so then that's right. But when did the axe come down, roughly?
Well, 2003 is when it switched from the Air Force to Navy over to DARPA. But I think before then, what we started to see, Der Spiegel came over to interview us, and Spiegel TV came over to take a look at the thing, and they refused to even grant them interviews, and that began around 2003. It really went dark at that point. University of Alaska Geophysical Institute gets a lot of money, military money. It's over $1 billion budget now. I mean, this is the University of Alaska. This is a very small university, but we have a very powerful U.S. senator that's able to do that, and because of its location, for studying the ionosphere, Alaska does, in fact, have the best location within the continental United States. So it's important from a research perspective. What we're concerned about is the dark nature and misapplication of technologies. I mean, we support a strong military and defense system, but let's make sure that it serves our interests.
Of course. And let's have some oversight with regard to how the testing is done. Do you know what kind of oversight has, if any at all, been in place with regard to what HAARP is doing?
Well, the only oversight is essentially the military looking at themselves. And, and this is a bit of a problem. This is where the European Parliament has expressed their greatest level of concerns. And, you know, interestingly enough, when we testified at the European Parliament, it was February 5th, 1998, and a resolution was passed in January of 1999 that dealt with HAARP, and it was in the context of the largest and most comprehensive security and disarmament resolution ever passed by the European Parliament. And our sections on HAARP calling for open disclosure and a complete investigation were actually passed by the highest margins. The one section that we got added in underneath the HAARP sections was Section 27, and it calls for an international convention introducing a global ban on all developments and deployments of weapons which might enable any form of manipulation of human beings. And the reason we got that in the context of the HAARP dialogue, is we expanded that dialogue to include what are called non-lethal weapons and explained how HAARP could be used in this way. And then we demonstrated in the European Parliament in an open hearing an infrasound device that transferred sound information directly through our own biological neural network, our nervous system, into the brain. When we demonstrated that, that cinched it in terms of that section, in the act. And we also said that the same.
Hold tight, just one moment. We're right up against the clock and a break. From Manila, in the Philippines, I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. Once again, Dr. Nick Begich. Bob in Montreal, Canada says, hey, Art, is there a relationship between HAARP and cell phones? Can HAARP tap into cell phones somehow? And I think the answer to that is clearly no. HAARP has other uses. But a good question for the good doctor. It just runs right into that in a way. There have been a lot of recent reports. We've had guests here on the show talking about cell phones being used to monitor conversations as bugging devices.
Right.
Dr. Begich, this is something you've been working on, apparently. What do you know?
Well, you know, we actually wrote about this in January of 2000 in the book Earth Rising the Revolution, and we talked about what are referred to as roving wiretaps, and it was permitted under law. And you know, and what has happened is there's been a recent court case where actually the FBI finally, through this the judge's action, ended up being tagged as being able to use the roving wiretap method this way. Once they get a warrant on someone, what they can do is trigger cell phones within the vicinity of that individual by downloading a little bit of software into those cell phones to where they actually kick on and act as a microphone. And every cell phone has this capability. And when you think about it, it's kind of a way to sweep into a neighborhood. You know, you can get close proximity to an individual, kick open somebody's cell phone, maybe not even that person's, and then monitor the conversation. The same thing, according to the articles that were released on this recently, they can do the same thing with the OnStar systems that are in many of the modern automobiles, where you have this emergency link up where you can talk to someone with the appropriate warrants, and now those are pretty liberally given. It's quite easy. The electronics actually, not just as a microphone, but something else that we've talked about for years is the requirement that cell phones have a GPS system, a geographic positioning system built in. They said it was for our safety for those 911 calls so they could locate us. The reality is every time you make a phone call, where you call and when you call, and who you call are all three of those data elements tracked. And in roving wiretaps, they have the ability to literally capture all of those conversations within a region, and supposedly they're not going to access the data without warrants. But consider this. If all data is kept and stored, and sometime down the road they decide to take a look at your personal communications, they can take a backward look and open up your entire life. And this is this is the very tip of the surveillance iceberg In terms of where it's headed. And we've been reporting on it now 6 years, and finally the mainstream media is starting to pick up on some of the themes that we were getting out of the Department of Justice newsletters out to law enforcement. I mean, we were looking at all of the things they were doing internally as they begin to build the bridges to these technologies for domestic use.
All right. I want to talk about this a little bit. I believe it's true. I think that it's a technology that's well within our reach. That is to say, put a little software on somebody's phone, turn it on, listen to what's being said. Now, that's pretty radical. However, given the threat against the United States, the current threat against the U.S., 9/11 and since.
Right.
I'm not, if I was the president of the United States and I was presented with this option as a way to protect the citizens, and I understand all the ways that it can be misused. However, I think that if I was the president of the U.S., I might very well authorize something like that, as big brotherish and horrible as many people believe it to be, certainly in misuse, I might authorize it because I just don't know how we fight what we're facing otherwise, Doctor.
Well, you know, I think this is just by the hesitation in your voice, I know that you wrestle with that even as you think about it, as we all
do. Of course.
The balance of safety and security against liberty and freedom. And I can't remember how the saying goes, but I mean, if you bank on your safety and security, you in exchange for liberty, you end up with neither. And I think
right.
That's probably true in the long run. I was reminded of that recently by an individual who talked to me about that. And you know, I struggle with it because it's always that balance. But at the same time, who sets the perimeters? You know, as long as everything is running smoothly and we go, well, we don't have anything to hide, we're not really worried about it. But every once in a while, somebody surfaces that has a different view of what's right and what's wrong than maybe most of us share. And the access to information and misuse of information seems to be the hallmark of a government that operates in secrecy. Now, granted, international terrorism is a significant issue. In fact, if you go back to a paper written by the U.S. Army War College, called The Revolution, Military Affairs, and Conflict Short of War. It was written in 1990. And what it was about, this Revolution, Military Affairs, was about changes in the technology that would allow for incredible capabilities, including these kinds of surveillance capabilities. They talked about implant technology for tracking people's movements and so on. And what this paper at the U.S. Army War College said is these technologies would violate American values. Now, most of us think, okay, that's where it stops, but it didn't. It said we need to change American values by creating an environment of fear predicated on international terrorism and international drug trafficking. Now, this is the U.S. Army War College's paper, and when that paper came out, you kind of look at that, and 9/11 provided that opportunity in the sense that safety and security was the only issue at that moment, and people sort of looked the other way, and then after, you know, the Patriot Act and other acts passed, people went back and went, wait a minute, you know, hundreds of local governments said, wait, we've gone too far. But that's exactly the situation they needed. Now, put this in perspective, international terrorism, as it affects American citizens, if you add up everything, including our casualties in Afghanistan and Iraq, we might come up with a number of around 10 or 12,000 in 10 years, which is a very big number. And no disrespect to anyone who's lost someone in any of these incidences, but compare it to medical malpractice in 10 years in the United States, according to Harvard, and a million people died.
Yeah, and or compare it to Vietnam,
sure.
and so forth and so on. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. But we do live in a day and age where eventually somebody's going to get hold of a nuclear device or a biological device that could wipe out a large part of the world.
Right.
That is what we're facing. Now,
right.
I'm well aware of our Bill of Rights. I'm very much aware of and in love with the Fourth Amendment. And we have lost some of those rights. There's absolutely no question about it. In fact, we've sort of given them away. But you know, during the Second World War, as an example, Dr. Begich,
right.
We also, for a period of time during the war, gave away or were stripped of, however you want to think of it, those rights. And they were returned.
Right.
Now, and even strengthened after the war.
Sure.
So
there was a difference. There was a declaration of war against specific states. We're having a declaration against individuals who travel around the planet with no state affiliation whatsoever.
True.
We have never had a congressional declaration of war in this instance. In those situations where a war is truly declared by the Congress of the United States, not by the President, as is provided in the Constitution, at that point then, the suspension of civil liberties are understood. But when it's done under the guise of accelerating fear and stripping of civil liberties, it's really, what is this war about if it's not about maintaining the integrity and character of the Constitution? And then we see,
I don't think we're ever going to have another declared war, do you?
Well, I don't know. You know, I wouldn't say that. I think this country is certainly capable of doing that. I mean, we are for the first time since the Roman Empire, you know, we are the most powerful guy on the block. There is no one on the planet that can challenge us at the moment in the way that that we've been challenged in the past. So I think we've been running sort of unilateral wars and without declaration, without cooperation in the full sense. But at the same time, I think that's the tendency to warfare is not going to go away. The issue of terrorism is not going to go away. I think what we're seeing is a hardening a greater degree of terrorism, I think, will emerge as we continue into this century just because of conflicts between states.
No doubt. So, Doctor, if you were the president and they came to you and said, look, 9/11 is the beginning. Eventually, we're going to have suicide bombers here. We're going to have somebody's going to get a nuclear weapon into and or close to the coast or a biological weapon. And the only way we can fight this, because it's not a conventional war, we're not going to have that kind of war anymore. Well, if there would be time to declare war before a full nuclear exchange, maybe there would be one more declaration, but it would be the last. So the future of warfare has changed. It's going to be what we're facing right now.
Right.
And other than the ability to gather information to prevent this kind of an attack, either we have that or we get attacked. And if you were the president, given that choice, knowing that that's true, and it is true, Doctor.
Yes.
What would you do?
Well, I think there is provisions in the law. There is the foreign intelligence courts and other courts that provide opportunities to go in and get the appropriate warrants with the appropriate steps. And there are people who are on their suspect list that certainly ought to be monitored. And, you know, when you look at this right now, over 60% of the cases the FBI is bringing right now forward for prosecution in the case of terrorism, according to recent articles, are being rejected by the Justice Department as not substantiated by the evidence. In other words, they can't even take them to trial. Now, I don't believe that the FBI is always right on target. In fact, right before 9/11, if you recall, the month before, the FBI was being raked over the coals by the Congress for messing up some of the biggest investigations in the country. And after 9/11, we gave them more power, more authority, more money, and less accountability. And I don't think that's an appropriate response. I think we need to make sure that they are operating efficiently. I think they need the latitude that they already have within the courts to gain those warrants. But I don't believe that every American should be the subject of that kind of inquiry. I just don't think that is the appropriate response. The appropriate response is isolate who's who, which we do a very good job of, and had things worked a little smoother, we might have been able to avoid some of the problems of the past. But the fact is, we have provision in law that allow the latitude government needs. When you start to look at how far that goes, certainly the overstepping of that is often the case, and unfortunately that's sort of the tension between the regulators and the bureaucracy in figuring out what's in our best interest. I think the President of the United States makes some very tough calls. I don't care whether liberal or conservative, the calls they have to make are the toughest ones of all. But at the same time, they are pledged to support and defend the Constitution. If you go back and look at the Founding Fathers' view, it was this idea of self-determination, independence, and the idea that people had a right to self-determination. We're in a conflict in Iraq, as an example, and we're there to win the hearts and minds and spread democracy. But that's not what the people apparently want. They want a theocracy, and if that's what they want in their own right to self-determination, maybe we need to recognize individual sovereignty as long as they keep it within the boundaries of their country and learn to leave people alone. We're the only country in the world with 800 bases and stations around the world to monitor and interfere with everyone else's politics. Maybe it's time to pull back a little bit towards our own borders, allow some governments to function. If they violate another state, if they violate the United States, I say stomp them into the Stone Age, as we did in Afghanistan. When we said give those guys up and they didn't do it, I think we were fully justified. But we need to take a very close account. When you talk about weapons of mass destruction, back in 1998, the Jerusalem Times reported that enough plutonium had escaped the former Soviet Union to build 25 suitcase-sized nukes. We know they're around. We also know the materials used to construct nuclear weapons produce signatures that are very unique and can be located with a certain degree of efficiency when they're on the surface and not properly shielded, which is when you're transporting this stuff.
That's right.
And so you can't really hide them. The more sophisticated weapons, the electromagnetic weapons, are based on very unique frequencies and pulse widths and wave shapes and forms so that they can be picked out of the ether quite easily. So you really can't hide this stuff so easily. I think we have a lot more visibility than we think. The idea of biologicals are even a bigger problem. And historically, if you go back to the conflicts between Iran and Iraq when they were using chemical and biological weapons, the United States supported Iraq in the development of those weapons to counter what was going on with Iran. And the evidence of that has been presented by many authors over the years, including the receipts for the technology transfer signed by the Bush-Reagan White House.
Now, when you noted the hesitation in my voice, of course you are exactly correct. I only say this with the greatest hesitation and concern and worry. I don't like the fact that the Fourth Amendment is in rags and tags. I don't like it one bit. I don't understand how we fight this potential threat that would take out U.S. cities or worse. Biological, nuclear, whatever it might be, I just don't get how we fight this threat effectively without these kinds of, without the kinds of technologies we're talking about right now.
Well, I think we can use these technologies, again, when they're properly ordered by court action. And these court orders are very easily obtained. I mean, the foreign intelligence courts routinely granted them. Now, the Bush administration had a lot of warrants declined just for, I mean, really, really a lot of lack of evidence, because to get one through was fairly easily accomplished. You know, in today's flight down to Dallas, I read a book called Light and Liberty, and it's Thomas Jefferson's ideas about the founding ideas of the country. And it's really timely because, you know, when you think about what these founding fathers envisioned, wasn't a country that went out and engaged in every foreign conflict. In fact, it was just the opposite. It was one that recognized the role of government at the federal level was to find the maximum happiness for its population, not to intrude in other people's foreign affairs. And I think we've created a lot of the problems by thinking that the Constitution somehow stops at the border of our country and we can go around the world and interfere with other people's politics, as we have. And I think this is, you know, this breeds a foreign policy that is hidden from public view, and foreign policy ought to be squarely in front of the American people so that we can weigh in on what is appropriate for our government to do. And in the case of using our technology to defend this country, I say develop the best and highest technologies, use them with proper oversight. And that's a big part of the problem. You know, the oversight is restricted in many cases to a very small select committee of the Congress, where they go in and look at black projects. And the problem is the level of scientific knowledge in the Congress. And I know this. My father was a United States congressman.
I know.
My family's been in politics for 50 years. And the level of scientific knowledge in the Congress is significantly deficient. I mean,
I fully understand.
You know, they talk about the Internet, and they talk about it as a bunch of tubes and pipes, for goodness sakes. And this was the chairman of Commerce, Science, and Technology Committee in the U.S. Senate. That's a sad state of affairs. And that needs to be addressed because technology is doubling every 9 to 10 months from the invention of the wheel to where we are at the moment.
And well, Doctor, maybe congressmen and senators need a technological liaisons who will help them understand
Absolutely.
What it is. I mean, that's about the only way, because they're political animals. They're not technologists. They need somebody who can tell them really what they're voting on. Doctor, hold it right there. We're here at the top of another hour already. Dr. Nick Begich is my guest. A relationship between RFID tags and cell phone technology, that is coming next. Stay right where you are. All right. Back now to Dr. Nick Begich. Indeed, Dr. Begich, there's some apparent relationship between RFID tags and cell phone technology.
Right. This technology, RFID tags, in fact, in terms of how they're being used, are being put in virtually everything. And as the cost for these tags continues to drop, the thought is they will eventually end up in the currency itself. And I'm going to read a really short quote. It's from July 3rd, 2001 from CNET News, and it says, and I quote, Hitachi has developed a chip that could be woven into paper money to help identify counterfeiters and could also have wide ramifications for identification and surveillance technologies. For example, chips could be implanted into all paper money and be connected wirelessly to the Internet so that authorities would be able to monitor the movement of all cash. Now, this gets connected not just through cell phone technologies, which now interface easily with the Internet. They're virtually all set up for that, the newer phones. The connection is, think about Bluetooth in the wireless world, where supposedly when you walk into your home, your various appliances will eventually know that's you and the coffee pot will know to turn on and so on. Well, that requires a unique identifier tagged to the individual. This is where the cell phone really comes into play, because when you think about it as your personal communicator device, something uniquely ID'd to you, that's the beginning of that porthole to hook you into those systems. Now, think about currency being developed in this way. So when you go to the bank and you cash your check, they know exactly which bills you hold. So then you go transfer those bills at the grocery store and maybe at the garage sale, but the guy at the garage sale doesn't have a reseller ID, a business license, or what have you, but the IRS knows he just collected money because sometime or somewhere along the line, he goes and spends it. In other words, every single cash transaction, every single movement, as you put that cash in your pocket and you run around town and you go buy these little wireless receivers and transmitters that pick up those little bits of information to know that that's you moving across town, they can literally track every movement you make. And this is the invasiveness of this technology, because it will be used, again, for our safety and security and to get rid of the black economy in terms of, again, using international drug trafficking, international terrorism as the rationale for absolute control and tracking of all currency transactions. When you think about that within the cell phone regime, it's just one reflection of that, because right now so much data is collected. It's been used in criminal cases as far back as the 1990s in Switzerland when they would track the movements of people. When you start to look at RFID tags in conjunction with this, they're going to be on everything. When you go to the store and you buy a shirt, it'll be in the tag. So the next time you walk in the store, they'll know, John Smith is back. They watch John Smith's movements, see how he reacts to various
Okay, let me stop you for a second. I want to understand. Maybe I don't understand RFID tags correctly. It was my understanding that an RFID tag, for example, on a shirt you would buy or something else, was to stop theft, so that if you walked through, the little that's not what it's for?
No, I mean, certainly it can be used in that way, and certainly it is used in that way, but an RFID tag is an inventory tracking device. And what does that really mean? Now, from the standpoint of a store, they want to know everything they can about you as a consumer. Everything they can tag to you individually allows them on a finer and finer basis to target advertising you're most likely to respond to.
Sure.
Advertising is going to become so personal that they won't even talk to you about things that your profiles indicate you're not going to be interested in. What they call in Europe now data valence, taking data and looking at your data shadow is what they refer to in the European Parliament. All of the transactions, all of your behaviors that can be warehoused in data banks and analyzed by very sophisticated computer models can then project what you're going to do, what you're going to buy, what you're going to respond to. This can be used even politically. I mean, if a candidate, for instance, could figure out what the one issue out of maybe the 100 issues that you disagree with, there's one that you agree with, that's the only message you'll ever hear from that individual during the course of a campaign. That's the way this data is going to be developed, so that you
only get...
All right,
talk to me, Doctor, about RFID tags specifically. When I walk out of a store with a shirt with an RFID tag, what can that RFID tag, is it an active transmitter? No, it isn't.
No.
Is it?
You have to be close to a system that can read it. And that's where the Bluetooth and some of these other technologies that are emerging that are basically proliferating everywhere. I mean, they're going to be every place. So as you pass these various positions that can then send the signal to activate the tag and read it, because a lot of the corporations now are cross-linked. In other words, they share their data, they share their information. The more they gather, the better the profile, the better the marketing, and the easier it is to target the marketing. And it's
that
about the marketing, not just about security.
All right. So how do I still don't get how RFID tags and cell phones go together.
From the standpoint that the cell phone becomes the easiest device to use to trigger. I mean, if you're carrying your phone, you've got your own ID identified easily because it's your telephone. Being able to activate an RFID tag using the cell phone as the activator is where we see that technology going, where cell phones become an integral part. I mean, for most people, young people particularly, they don't even get hard lines anymore. They get a cell phone. That's the only communication they have. Everywhere they go, everywhere they move, that data is stored. And it used to be stored just short periods of time because storage was expensive. Well, storage isn't expensive now. You store everything indefinitely, and it's getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper to do. And so the RFID tag provides, from the standpoint of commerce and marketing, a way to track virtually everything a person buys once these things are integrated into every inventory item. And the big commercial merchandisers are insisting that this happen as rapidly as possible because it offers them incredible opportunities to mine the data and look at the data and hone their marketing in a way that really not only becomes manipulative in the sense that you only get information that you're most likely to respond favorably to, and you're denied information that you would find objectionable. And, you know, when you think about that, you really want full disclosure, you know, when you make decisions. Maybe some things like buying a pair of socks doesn't matter, but perhaps electing an official or making some major purchase, it does matter. And you're not going to get that full information. It's going to be tailored specifically for you. RFID tag offers a method of inventory control, but it also offers a method of controlling the flow of all goods, all services, all currency into a single system of integration. And
what do you know about RFID tags and currency? Where are we with that? That one concerns me now.
Well, we're pretty close. I mean, the cost now is down to where I would suspect that within the next 5 years you're going to see it implemented, and you're going to hear the announcements and the proclamations about why it has to be done for our own safety and security and to get rid of the drug trafficking and the money flowing out, plus counterfeiting, international counterfeiting by states like Korea, for instance, copying our money and circulating, you know, millions of dollars. These kinds of problems are getting more and more news play, which to me is usually the first, you know, sort of the prelude to what's coming. They create enough anxiety over the problem. People start getting burned with bad money, and then they want a more secure bill, and then this becomes the outcome. And
yeah, but is it really? I mean, it seems everything we do can be undone. So if we can RFID currency, then some jerk is going to be able to duplicate RFID currency.
Sure, I think that just goes. I think that definitely goes on. You know, these things will be serialized, so there might be some unique way to do that. But you're right. I mean, almost every technology at some point or another, and that's been the chase on currency. You know, we've seen our currency in the U.S. change more in the last 10, 15 years than we ever saw before as they try to get ahead of the counterfeiters. This is just one more step. And I agree with you. I think there's a certain amount of insecurity that we have to accept, because the idea of tracking every single bill, for most people, when you raise this issue, the first objection, you know, starts to come out. Well, wait a minute, you know, why would I want everything I do tracked in this manner? And most, I have not met anyone yet who thought it was a great idea.
Okay, clear something up for me. The newer bills, some of the newer bills have this almost teeny little metallic vertical strip
right
in them. What is that?
That's it's an ID. It's a unique ID. I mean, you can pull the strip out. If you split the bill at the top, you can actually lift that strip right out.
Really?
And it's a Mylar film. Some have suggested that it's already got some capability of being read. I don't know whether that's accurate or not. You know, I've heard that, but I have not seen. And you know how I am about documents. If I don't see,
so they don't tell us what that is then.
They say it's a Mylar strip for avoiding counterfeiting, because it's very tough to weave into the fabric and to get this to get this actually in the bill. So it's kind of a super safety thing. I mean, if you look at European currency, the euro, for example, you'll see these same filaments woven into the paper along with multicolors and all of the things that we do, ink blots and so on, to try and get something that's more difficult to counterfeit. And I think that's basically been the premise, is this would make it much more difficult. You can't Xerox, for instance, like some people have done, and pick that up. I mean, you really have to have pretty sophisticated capability to counterfeit that. And that's where we're seeing governments like Korea doing some of this, because they do have the ability and they do have the budgets. It's cheaper to print money, I guess, than to get it legitimately, and even they figured that out.
All right, so you don't think it's anything more ominous than that? You don't think it's some form of RFID tag?
At this point, I have not seen anything that would indicate that. I don't have access to all the information out there. There may even be listeners that have information on this, but I've always stuck with whatever the documents support, and in this case, I just don't have anything that would support that Mylar strip being an RFID tag at the present time.
Okay, I know there's a very great deal of worry here in the Philippines about the validity of bills. And whether it's U.S. currency that you're exchanging or it's pesos here, they look at every bill. They examine every bill so carefully.
Right.
So there's a lot of forgery going on. No question about it. Okay, that's interesting. So eventually you see cell phones actually activating RFID tags, and then, see, here's the part I don't understand. If it's for marketing purposes, I cannot imagine, let's say, a large chain being able to go out and massively activate cell phones, activate RFID tags, and get marketing information by the millions and millions and millions, which... otherwise, I just don't see companies getting that kind of technology in their hands, or our government allowing that to occur. Is that what you see?
No, I see it the other way. I see the providers collecting data and then marketing that data in terms of whatever they can collect. I mean, already you're looking at data banking. And when you start to think about, what do companies have to sell? They sell their mailing lists. They sell all kinds of data. But when you can get specific profiling, I mean, credit card companies do this all the time based on your transactions, and then they sell the lists that you can actually request in a very tailored way to get a certain demographic and a certain zip code that with certain buying patterns, you can already do a lot of this. So the idea of larger organizations collecting data is extremely valuable to marketing entities. I don't see like a private company going out and then activating a bunch of cell phones, but I do see the cell phone company collecting a lot of data and then utilizing that data in a way that that builds markets and builds markets.
Do they have that legal right?
It's a good question. You know, a lot of the laws are ill-defined because the technologies and the laws have not sort of matched each other. You know, in recent years, for instance, electronic harassment using the internet was not prosecutable in most states, and yet if you harass somebody with a telephone or the mail or personally, you could be arrested. But because it didn't deal with the internet specifically, I was a victim of such harassment, and that's what I found. Alaska finally changed the laws, but laws have not kept up with much of the technology. The issue of privacy as it relates to technology, we need a complete review of where.
All right, now here's where you're making it just a wonderful point, and let's go backwards. I think what I said earlier, that congressmen and senators absolutely have got to have now on their staff some sort of technological liaison, somebody who really knows what the hell's going on, because obviously they don't, and they're politicians. They're worried about getting reelected, and they can't possibly keep up with technology and the speed with which it's changing. They just can't. So they need liaisons on their staff. Is that something that's happening now, or if it isn't, then it needs to?
There's not enough of it, and it's like technology translators, people who can read through actually. They need to be cross-disciplinary teams, I think, within the Congress, of people that have enough knowledge across the disciplines to sit down and analyze technologies and review their implications in advance of, you know, in advance or else in conjunction with deployment. Because things are happening so fast, it's almost like it runs out in front of us and we go, oh, wait, there might be consequences here. And then we try to catch up and we never catch up. We need that sort of cross-disciplinary review and a little more surface discussion in terms of the technologies. Much of what happens in this area is driven by commercial interests that are interested in collecting the information. My eldest son has his master's in e-commerce, and he had actually looked at some of the theoretical models being developed for using data collected electronically. And the companies that he's worked for and the background that he's had, what we know is that the entire networking of data is really so valuable today, because spending money on advertising, I mean, people can spend it here or there, but directing it specifically and targeting it in very specific ways is where advertising is headed. I mean, that's where most sophisticated advertisers are already going. Most of the big academic institutions are looking at ways to hone that so people's advertising dollars are even more effectively spent at influencing outcomes. Political outcomes, particularly, I mean, now for presidential elections, $1 billion gets spent. That's a big budget, and there's a lot to be said for using data and then manipulating
mm-hmm.
data.
Mm-hmm. What about this movement? It's only beginning experimentally right now, but they actually are beginning to implant chips in human beings. Now, they've been doing it with animals for some time,
right,
for probably a good reason. Now, what about chips and human beings? What do you know?
Well, you know, down in Mexico, the Attorney General's office planted several 100 employees with microcircuits under the surface of skin. When you go back again to the document Revolution, Military Affairs, and Conflict Short of War from 1990, the U.S. Army War College, they did, at that time they could basically monitor location, you know, for GPS purposes. And for special forces now, they utilize them where if you're in combat, they actually know your location. But more than that, the new chips can actually determine heart rate, respiration, many of your physical perimeters, whether you're breathing at all or dead, where you're located. I mean, a lot of data. Some of the most sophisticated circuits, MIT released a story several years ago where a microcircuit the size of the first numeral on a date of a dime is used for medical diagnoses. The newest chips, the ones that are being developed today, are even getting smaller. I mean, when they're looking at the capability of microcircuits, given the direction of the technology, being able to get so small that what we used to have, you know, I mean, think about computers. What used to fill a house now fills a watch.
Oh, of course. And look, all of this, for example, as it would apply to, say, a special forces soldier, is completely understandable.
Absolutely. I would support that 100%. And if I were in combat, I think I would probably even take the chip just to know that I could
bet.
Be extracted.
You bet.
But in that paper, they talk about implanting business travelers. And the idea was we wouldn't activate the system, of course, unless there was some problem. And if you believe that, you know, I mean, I think we need to reexamine the whole issue. But the idea of positive ID, you know, in terms of ID coming in the passports here, after the first part of the year, they're going to require biometrics, the ID of something unique identifier to you within your passport. If you want to exit, get through customs a little faster, in the most obscure place, Alaska Magazine Airlines Magazine, December 2006, writing down on the airplane, they're now putting iris scanners in the Vancouver International Airport, and you can give an interview, photographs, fingerprints, and background checks, and your iris scan, and then you don't have to go through customs in the way everybody else does. This is the trend and direction in which all customs and all transits between countries will eventually take place.
Wow.
And they've already done it in Canada, and they've already done it at Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam and have it active as Schiphol Airport iris scans for at least 4 years for those frequent travelers that don't want to be bugged by customs.
So right now it's voluntary. There are a lot of people out there, people of faith, who think that the Bible says that eventually the involuntary chip is coming. We'll be right back. All right, Doctor, we're going to go to phones at the top of the hour, but I've got a number of questions I want to clear up fairly quickly if I'm able to.
Okay.
And the first is that involuntary. That's a big one, of course. Is that where we're headed when eventually we're going to – I mean, they've talked about national ID cards. This is
right.
Just the modern version of a national ID card, a chip in your hand or wherever they put it, right?
That's correct. And, and already they've piloted some of this, not with with the microcircuits, primarily with special service personnel, they're talking more about, the military IDs that they put out with a lot of information a number of years ago. This is the next logical step because, again, counterfeiting issues, how do you counterfeit a human being? You know, once they stick this under your skin, you're definitely ID'd in a way that is irrefutable, indisputable. The problem is exactly what you're suggesting is this is the ultimate control of the individual, and I don't believe that's anything like what the founding fathers envisioned, and certainly violates religious tenets. And I think that's going to be where the tension is, because this is going to be one of those issues that unites the left and the right together, whether it's for civil liberties purposes or for biblical reasons. It's going to bring people together around a common theme that freedom and liberty, the things that bind us together, and allow that diversity within this culture have to be preserved, and is preserved on a platform of privacy and integrity of the individual. These things violate that integrity. The idea of manipulating people, controlling people's movements, should be an affront to any free people anywhere on this planet. The other issue, and the issue that kind of creeps and overlaps, is the areas of, and what we had talked to in the last hour, about the idea of manipulating even human behavior. Now, when you start to overlay all of these technologies, you get a very directed and controlled society where people are reduced to taxpayers and consumers rather than the human beings that we are. These are invasive technologies that, on the one hand, give us the illusion of security, and on the other hand, strip us of our very humanity.
Indeed. All right. Well, I think that's where the foot would come down. I don't think that would. There are just too many people of faith that wouldn't allow it to happen. I want to circle back to something we talked about earlier, the ability to turn on a cell phone, use it as a bugging device. Now, we can have arguments about whether it's justified with the threat our country faces right now, but that's not the nature of my question. My question is this. If it's possible for the providers to really do this, to turn on a microphone and a cell phone and listen, then why isn't it possible that some little genius out there will figure out what the providers already know, if in fact they do, and the ability to listen to anybody's cell phone will fall into the hands of private detectives and then ultimately just to a very bright individual?
Well, actually, it's already possible. According to a December 1st, 2006 article that appeared on CNETnews.com, that whole issue of private investigators already have the capability, but they say it's illegal, so they can't do it. Now, anyone who's been around very many private investigators
Please.
Knows that there's a lot of things they do that may not be legal, and they do it because they're not necessarily using the information for a criminal or civil case. It's for other purposes. A lot of rules get violated because you can. Technology, being able to hack or write code that you could download into phones, I mean, every system is vulnerable. Even the Joint Chiefs of Staff, according to an article that we clipped, had Chinese hackers get into their personal and private databases. So, you know, tapping into cell phone technology, apparently, according to the article, is not a problem for anyone with the will, desire, and a little bit of financing and ability to write some code. And, you know, when we look at that across the board, think about, you know, this whole direction of warfare and info war deals with the idea of being able to hack the other guy's system. The more technologically dependent we are, the more vulnerable we also are to these kinds of intrusions. In the case of China, we know from the research that comes out of the Senate Intelligence Committee that is released that this is one of their primary areas of interest, is how to hack through into our infrastructure systems and utilize them. If they could figure out a way to hack into the congressional cell phone lines, believe me, they will do it, and they may already be doing it, because the technology, if it's available to private investigators in the United States, is available to anybody running any sophisticated government anywhere in the world.
What a world. All right. We wanted to cover something called electrosmog. Now, we are, of course, radio, television signals, microwave, all of these things are completely invisible. If they were, in fact, visible, we would be inundated. We wouldn't be able to see 2 inches in front of our face. All of this is passing through us and around us all the time.
Right.
Is there something associated with electrosmog that's new that we need to understand that's affecting us biologically in some way?
Well, yes. And when you start to look at it from the standpoint of stress within the population, you see it dramatically increasing. And electrosmog as a concept, there's actually a paper, you can find it on SwissRe.com, which is Swiss Reinsurance. So the people that write reports for underwriters and insurance companies so they don't take unnecessary risks, they have a report called Electrosmog. It's been out for a number of years, but it basically says to the insurance industry, don't insure these risks. In other words, the risks are so great, they say that in the event that the biophysicists are correct, and the insurance industry is insured risk, it'll bankrupt the insurance industry. So they do not. Even Lloyd's of London, for instance, won't insure cell phone risks based on electromagnetic emissions coming from the phones, because the risk is too great. When you start to see the insurance industry say, hey, the evidence is in, we're not insuring the risk, even though the scientific community might want to still argue about it, insurance companies don't argue about what they're going to lose money on. They just take the
savings. So you're telling me that insurance companies have turned down, I don't know what it would be, some sort of insurance for cell phone manufacturers, perhaps against a class action lawsuit, that sort of thing? Is that
that's
what
exactly,
we're talking about?
That's exactly right. And we covered this in the book Earth Rising 2, The Betrayal of Science, Society, and the Soul. And it's really, when you start to look at the technologies in terms of cell phones and cell phone safety, and just if you take RF alone, radio frequency energy alone, from what nature naturally produces in the background, we've added 200 million times more radio frequency energy surrounds us every day. And that's what's called electrosmog. I'll tell you, when you notice it, the changes, including the power grid that surrounds us at 60 cycles, when the power goes down, the first thing everyone feels is how quiet it is. Obviously, the motors aren't running, but you almost feel like your whole body exhales and you relax, because your body is compensating for these external fields all the time, trying to find equilibrium. As soon as you remove those fields, the stress is relieved, the body relaxes. And that level of stress, when you think about it in urban areas, I left Alaska, and the background radiation was pretty mild. I've got a detector that goes from 50 megahertz to 3,000 megahertz for microwave radiations, and it makes very distinct noises when you're around it. In my home in Alaska, I got nothing, virtually no signal. I came down here to Dallas in this hotel room, and everywhere I go, this thing gives me a reading that tells me I'm inundated with electromagnetic fields here in the microwave range that I was not exposed to in my home state of Alaska, as an example.
I'm certain that's true. Wait until the next time you travel to Las Vegas. It has more two-way radiation than in any other city in the world. And so next time you travel to Las Vegas, let me know how your meter does there. So you believe there are Are there scientifically verifiable biological effects from this?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the finest biophysicists in the world, a gentleman by the name of Dr. Alexander K. Varanin, he was a former head of the biophysics lab for the USSR Academy of Sciences for 10 years. He was that lab's director in biophysics. He is one of the most brilliant. He's a visiting professor at 12 universities. He spent 6 weeks with me in Alaska at one occasion, and he's being brought into a closed conference of a number of specialists in the same league to discuss some of the ramifications of these technologies. The Lay Institute on Technology is actually sponsoring a closed conference, and I'm bringing together about nine of the best scientists in the world. Their CVs, their resumes, fill up an inch and a half thick notebook, and they're going to sit down with us and look at some of the most invasive technologies and begin to develop strategies for public education in these areas. And, you know, what we know from the biophysics is that electromagnetic fields have incredible effects. Alexander K. Varanin even did a paper, it's over 900 pages long, of a number of the effects of electromagnetic fields. On his websites are extensive documents. He even gets into some of the more esoteric subjects and breaks down the physics for some of these things, from new energy to the biophysics of how the body actually reacts to these various forms of radiation. So it's not so much a new area as it is a new area for the public. Biophysics is an old field. Electrophysiology, the first degrees were granted back in the 1940s. Jose Delgado, who was famous for his mind control work, actually had a degree in electrophysiology from 1950 from the University of Madrid, over 56 years ago. So, you know, these areas have been studied consistently for over six decades. The only thing that we've learned is that it takes less energy than we originally thought, that the real trigger is the frequency. It's almost like dialing in a radio station. When you get resonance between the transmitter and receiver, you get a nice clear signal. And the same is true in the human body and the human mind. And learning.
What do we know, Doctor, about what frequencies are more dangerous to biological entities, in other words, us?
Well, I mean, very specifically, you know, when you look at the brain can be overridden by external sources of energy. It's called FFR, frequency following response. You can use electromagnetic fields. You can use the flicker rate of a television set screen. You can use any carrier to carry a signal that will interact with the brain. And then you can put yourself into, for instance, if you're watching a television passively and you can control the flicker rate of that TV, you're already in a passive position. You can put the individual into a highly suggestive receptive state. This does not violate any laws, by the way, as long as you're not using subliminals, and you wouldn't need to, because what happens is the brain then drops into this state of accepting the information without much filtering, and that happens within the 30, 40 seconds of watching the advertisement. Then the overt advertisement words sink in, register, and most people sit on the fence anyway. This is enough to kick it over the top. That's the way in which a lot of this technology is and will continue to be applied. You can use any of these perimeters, and there is a huge body of research. We found over 300 sources and a number of patents that actually show the evolution of that technology, the state it is today. And that book was reviewed by two physicists, both of whom, in specialists in biophysics, said it is the absolute best on mind control that they've ever read, because
all right, but again, Doctor, what I'm asking is, what frequencies that you're aware of are more dangerous to biologic entities than others? I mean, we've got a whole range, virtually from where sound ends and radio emissions begin, up to light. Now, that's a big area, and some must be more dangerous to others than others, in that spectrum.
The extremely low-frequency signals appear to be the most biologically active. This is below 1,000 hertz, although there are some harmonics in higher frequencies that create biological action as well. But it's this lower range. I mean, when you think of the human brain operating primarily in its deepest states of sleep, 1 to 4 hertz or pulses per second, and then sort of in between sleep and awake, or where more 3 to 5 year old children spend their time, is in the theta range, 4 to 7 hertz. 7 to 12 hertz is where we are when we're in our most creative states, the alpha state. and then above 12 hertz, you get into beta. Now, when you go high beta states, 60 hertz, 70 hertz, you're getting into a highly agitated state, one where the brain is not operating at its optimum. This is where the danger starts to take place. Now, you can also, you can dial in. Every chemical, every compound, every body organ has unique frequencies. If you want to look at the gross body organs, you can go to the dosimetry handbook, the radio frequency dosimetry handbook produced by the University of Utah under a contract to the United States Air Force Science Advisory Board, where they broke down the specific frequencies for every vital organ in the body and how to override those vital organs using external energy sources.
Wow.
And that's a public document. It's not classified. It's available. If it's classified, it's only been in the last couple of years. But that is, in fact, the breakdown. And what's interesting about that paper is they don't talk about scalars. They only talk about vectors, except in one place in the definitions. In other words, all the parts that dealt with scalars were extracted. Those are classified. They left it in the definition section, which is kind of interesting. But this whole area of science, that was a 1985 study. That is 20 years old. I mean, they already knew then. When we traced the evolution of these studies through the military, we did it in a way that really broke it down, showing how they evolved their work and their models. And now what we saw, there is an open RFP by the military. We quote it in the book, Controlling the Human Mind. It's open until the year 2009, soliciting information, specific information on how to override and manipulate the body and the mind and the chemistry of the body using external energy sources.
All right. Well, here's what I would say. Most of this then must be totally at this point experimental, because we had the ability to control minds. If we had the ability to control populations in any way at all, I mean, look at how desperate things have become in Iraq. Obviously, we have not loosed this technology in Iraq in any meaningful way, or we'd be doing a lot better than we are right now. And certainly, it's a desperate situation at this point.
Yeah, you know, again, you know, we have our own people intermixed with what's going on in Iraq. But if you go back to the first Gulf conflict, Commando Solo was used, a project by the military where we use a very sophisticated a set of aircraft that actually interdict and get involved with the communications within a country. So what we did in that case, according to Scottish press, was we embedded signals on the radio broadcast broadcasting the Muslim music and prayers, and we put in signals that created anxiety and fear. And what did we see? The fourth largest army in the world give up like kids on their first fire drill. But we did not have our troops intermixed. We were still outside of those battle zones we were
coming
into.
That's a very good point.
And so now we're intermixed. Now, what they have introduced to the battlefield is this new device. It's a radio frequency dish mounted on a Humvee, supposedly to create heat sensations on the skin. It created a lot of controversy a few months ago when the Secretary of the Air Force, and I forget how you pronounce his name, I think it's Wynne, W-Y-N-N-E, came out and said, we need to test all these non-lethal weapons on Americans before we deploy them against our adversaries. And right after that, they deploy this crowd control weapon in Iraq. Now, what they didn't tell people is by changing the frequency, pulse width, many, many different parameters about that microwave radiation, according to the radio frequency dosimetry handbook, you can create more than just heat on the surface of the skin. You can manipulate or shut down any of the vital organs within the human body. And that's something they didn't bother to mention, but it shows up in all of their literature. One of the companies that have developed some of these technologies is a company called ADCO, A-T-C-O. It's owned by Woody Norris, who developed microwave heterodyning for transferring sound information directly into the brains of people where they hear that proverbial voice in the head without any physical contact on the body. And he won the MIT Lemelson Prize last year, $500,000 for that invention, something he said was possible.
Doctor, hold it right there. Dr. Nick Begich is my guest, and I'm turning him over to all of you next. We've certainly covered a lot of ground, so if you have questions, and I'll bet you do, that's coming up next. This is Coast to Coast AM. Once again, Dr. Nick Begich. Doctor, before we go to the phones, is there anything that we really should have covered in this interview that we have not yet covered?
You know, we've covered a lot of material, Art. I'll tell you, I think we've covered the bulk of the main topical areas. Obviously, we can't get into all the details You've got lots of archive programming of programs we've done with you and George, and I'm sure people can dial into that. I think we've really covered the major, major points on these issues, and callers always trigger memory, so hopefully we'll get some good questions, as we always do, and get into some more of these details.
All right. I've got just one before we plunge, and here it is. Other than something like a Faraday cage or some other obviously protective device against electromagnetic radiation, if somebody really is concerned about this, what can they do, if anything?
I don't believe that there are any technical fixes that are within the capability of most people. Even a Faraday cage, in the case of scalars, one of the leading university researchers in scalars at Munich University actually demonstrated to one of my colleagues energy transmissions that would pierce a Faraday cage, and had to do with the scalar technologies, very different than the kinds of technology we're normally familiar with. I don't think there is a single countermeasure that could be undertaken, although that is one of the subjects we're going to be discussing with our panel of experts when we get them together in Dallas, not just public education, but effective countermeasures that we might be able to talk about openly without jeopardizing, you know, rational approaches to national security. And you know, it's always a balance. I mean, as an independent researcher, for me to balance what I disclose, and I have never, ever worked with classified documents, nor would I ever do that. I think that, you know, if we want to argue about a classification, we use the legal process to do it. We use the open literature, and I think that's really got to be the way we approach this. And balancing the act is the critical element. Countermeasures are something we want to look into and have begun to look into. The unfortunate conclusion is there's no single system that can defend against all of these. A great article for people to get a handle on some of these technologies is an article called The Mind Has No Firewalls. It was produced by the U.S. Army War College in the spring of 98 in their publication online called Perimeters.
Okay. All right. Then here it comes. Wildcard line, I think it's Jonathan in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You're on the air.
Hi, I have a question concerning a future biological internet / control grid incorporating HARP and the human resonance. The number of humans on planet Earth is approaching the number of neurons in the brain. And Douglas Rushkoff, he proposes that the Earth itself might actually become awakened when all humans collectively become networked and resonate at the same frequency. So my question is, Dr. Nick, can you envision a future where a Wi-Fi biological internet using the Schumann resonance as a environmentally produced carrier wave, like a backbone, whereby the blanket frequency under the ionosphere is broadcast to, with say, HARP using ELF?
Okay,
transmitters.
Let's break this down a little bit for our listeners. Schumann's resonance is a frequency, the beat frequency of the Earth. It was recognized by a German in the early 50s at 7.83 hertz is what he determined, which happens to be right at the lower end of the alpha range, the ideal state for human beings to engage in creative and analytical work. It's interesting that the Earth and human beings require this particular beat frequency to get coherent, creative kind of thinking to go on. The idea of using the Earth itself, the magnetic fields of the Earth, to harmonize the brains of the planet is what Persinger at Laurentian University was talking about. He actually talked about this in a paper he published, as well as he spoke about it on a program aired February 7th, 1999, on CBC TV in Canada on a program called Undercurrents. It is absolutely possible, but I don't think it's a good thing. Any time that the human brain is interfered with by an external source without our consent, it is a violation of our fundamental right to free will and free thinking. And that's something that in the Christian tradition and in most religious traditions, even God will not do, and is the essence of what becomes evil in the world, the manipulation of what happens within our brains. And this is what the Air Force referred to in a recent article published in June 2004 under the auspices of the Electromagnetic Directorate out of Maxwell Air Force Base in a publication called Horizons. And Technology Horizons is the Air Force publication, and they said that they could replicate or duplicate all five senses, sight, sound, touch, taste, and smell, in such a way as to create complete memory sets or holograms. And this idea of controlled effects, controlling the human being as the optimum target of the U.S. Air Force in looking at warfare. And that is the violation of the very essence of who human beings are.
All right. First-time caller line, Bailey in Santa Rosa, California. Your turn with Dr. Bigich.
I was about to say good afternoon to you, but I believe it's probably after 5. So good evening, sir. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak. Well, altogether, doctor, may I ask you about cell phones? And also, whenever I go to a Safeway here in California and buy some groceries and everything, well, I use a discount card.
Right.
And evidently, they seem to find a whole lot of personal information that I didn't put on the application for the card in the first place. And, well, could you tell me exactly, again, how they find that?
Absolutely. It's the basic information that once you submit that card, every single thing in that basket, not just the discounted items, everything you bought is trackable. When they start to analyze that against large populations, they can come to certain generalized conclusions, and they actually get pretty refined. You know, we remember this racial profiling. This is market profiling, and then they can deduce things, so you'll get you'll get a shaver in the mail, you know, because they know that you use a hand shaver, not an electric shaver. You know, they want you to get hooked on whatever the blade is. I mean, these kinds of things happen, and they also send you discount coupons for the things that you're most likely to buy. This is something that advertisers and manufacturers really valuable knowledge. So you get a lot of shared advertising costs and a lot of promotional sharing when data can be developed that's highly refined. Very simple. This is the very basics of it. Your credit card transactions accomplish the same things on even a broader scale because it's not limited to just one store.
Okay. West of the Rockies, it would be Terry in Diamond Bar, California. You're on with Dr. Bigich.
Hi, Art. I'd just like to say thank God you're not in lockstep with your guest. First of all, I'd like to know whose side he's on. Is he on the side of innocent American civilians or on the terrorist rights to privacy? I mean, this guy's an extremist and an alarmist. He's got volumes and volumes of ramblings of preposterous nonsense that isn't going to harm anyone. Next thing you know, he'll be selling clot protection helmets. I mean, give me a break. And by the way, how dare you trivialize the murders of the 9/11 victims by comparing them to car crashes or people who are accidentally killed by machinery.
Okay.
I'm offended by you.
All right, caller, hold on.
I'd like to see your face.
Okay, hold on.
Well, you know, I think you share a minority opinion, quite frankly. The fact of the matter is we look at the issues from the standpoint of what this republic was based on. And it's not based on a controlled and directed society. It's based on free people. The idea of succumbing to the issue of fear and letting that drive this country's entire domestic and foreign policy is ridiculous on its face. The idea that we're sitting in Iraq for 4 years shoving democracy down the throats of people who would prefer a theocracy violates the very essence of self-determination as our founding fathers looked at it, which was to stay out of people's domestic affairs and mind our own business. The idea of international terrorism, I believe we should deal with them swiftly and rapidly. And the fact of the matter is we have not been doing that when we oppress American citizens as sort of the excuse, and that is the excuse. And if you look at the literature, everything we've covered tonight is cited. Over 1,650 sources. These aren't my words. These are the military words, the mainstream media's words, and the major academics in the world's words as to what is happening with this technology.
All right. Third wildcard line, it's Anita in New York City for Dr. Bigich.
Yes. Hey, Art. Excellent, excellent program. And, Nick, I just have to say to you, please stay on this very brave new world. I have a two-part question. Today, the TV news reported that when Diana was going through the tunnel, that the U.S. Secret Service was listening to her cell phone. So I'd like I'd like to find out first, and I'll listen over the air, if he heard that news report, and how does he figure that in terms of, you know, exactly what they were doing, since you were talking about it earlier. The second part of it concerns, I'm wondering if you're familiar with Sherman Skolnick. I had Googled him. He recently passed. But he had done some pieces on scalar technology and Hurricane Katrina. And when I got back to look at his articles, I didn't pull up those, but I got another one through Cloak and Dagger called Hurricane Katrina, Weather Warfare Conspiracy by Stefan Grossman. And I'd like him to tell us whether he's familiar with that and the woodpecker effect, the Soviet woodpecker effect, and he explains how EM transmitted could have created that storm. They certainly left those people abandoned, you know, without help, and even refused to let the Red Cross and others help. And I'll listen to your response. I love both of you.
Okay, thank you, Anita.
That was a lot of questions in one. Let me try and get these organized. In terms of Katrina, I have seen some of those reports, and I've looked at that. The idea of manipulating a storm system that large, with the experts that I've talked to, I really haven't seen the what I would call the evidence of that. You know, and again, I don't see everything. There are a lot of other researchers looking at some of these issues. In terms of Princess Di, I have not seen those reports.
I have. In fact, they admitted that indeed they were listening to her cell phone conversations. That was made public, Doctor.
Well, you know, and it, you know, nothing really surprises me in that regard. I mean, the idea of surveying and surveillance of every major player that's influencing public policy, you know, the whole issue of those that oppose American policy is actually embedded in a joint protocol for the development of certain weapon systems, non-lethal weapon systems. It's a protocol between the Department of Defense and the Department of Justice where they actually give priority funding for dual-use technologies. And the language used in that protocol is lifted right out of the chemical and biological treaties we signed a number of years ago, the section that grant domestic exemptions. In other words, what we can't use against a declared enemy, we can use against our own citizens according to that international treaty. And the language actually says it can be used for riot and control purposes and population control purposes within the boundaries of your own country. But the deal is, with this technology, is the targets are those that oppose American policy. And what's interesting about that is everyone in this country, including the caller who was a little bit angry at me tonight, have opposed American policy at one point or another, which makes all of us adversaries under that joint protocol of this government. And that is fundamentally flawed from its onset.
Doctor, you mentioned early in the interview that Dr. Eastland has turned his attentions toward weather control. How much progress has he made?
He's made quite a bit. And, you know, and Dr. Eastland, in my last conversations with him, indicated that he was not going to turn that over to military planners, that he was going to reserve that out and hopefully see some open civilian review of that technology. There's also a couple of pieces of legislation that have been kind of hanging around the Congress to set up a committee to actually oversee weather modification, both government and private side, because private side interest in this is growing. The Russians, for instance, offer electrostatics as a method for weather modification for people who are willing to pay the price.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what Dr. Eastland has turned his attention to is dealing with other anti-terror technologies, things that he can't really get into and I'm not going to talk about on the air, but things that I think are extremely important to the country, a sort of a redirection, and has opened his eyes to some of the biophysics that he was unfamiliar with in the past. And I think,
Doctor, while I understand that you cannot speak for Dr. Eastland,
right?
How would you characterize his feelings about DARPA bringing the black curtain of military secrecy down over what had been his baby?
Well, you know, there was always a level of secrecy involved in it. I mean, when he first pitched the program, and this is in the open literature, he pitched it to DARPA, and he also pitched it to a number of other people. One of the founders of TRW, Ramos, was one of the joint inventors on one of the patents. That's why it got such currency so rapidly, was he had buy-in from major players, as well as, you know, his career started at the Atomic Energy Commission. He has 19 patents to his name, 53 professional peer-reviewed papers, and dozens of lectures. But he is really a good man. And, you know, the thing that happens in science is often we are so over-specialized that we don't see the implications of one branch against another. That's something that Dr. Reason has told me that we brought to him, that realization that you need to take a broader view outside of your discipline and really understand and make sure that other disciplines are involved when you're developing science, so that the science is really good science.
Doctor, perhaps you could put in a good word and ask Dr. Eastland if he'd like to be interviewed.
You know, we almost had that at one point, and he was willing to go on, and he got involved in some projects that precluded it. But I believe that time will come again, and we'll be speaking with him in the next month or so, and we'll try and see if we can put that together again, Art.
Let's give it a try. On the first time caller line, Michael in Indiana, you're on the air with Dr. Begich.
Hey, Art, hi, Art. How are you doing tonight?
Okay,
listen, I know that the new study just came out on the cell phone usage, and they're trying to say that they're not giving anybody cancer right now. I find that kind of hard to believe, since we're being bombarded with all these waves like this, that they're not having some effect. And are those reports accurate?
Well, you're on a cell phone right now, aren't you?
Yeah, that's my only means of communication. That's what I'm saying. If you took them out of the hands of everybody, they'd go broke. The phone communications would go on the world. So are they giving us the facts on these?
Okay. Well, I see the reason for your question. Doctor?
Yeah, you know, cell phones are a hazard. If you look at George Carlo's work, Dr. George Carlo, he was hired by the industry. He was given a $25 million budget in 5 years to do an analysis of the effects of cell phones. He completed that. The industry came forward, said everything's safe, and George Carlo said, nope, you misinterpreted my research, and he wrote a book called Cell Phones, The Invisible Hazards in a Wireless Age, and he explains what he believes is the mechanism for cancer formation. Now, the problem with a lot of these studies is you don't have all of the data, and there's been other studies that directly conflict with that one that have been done with large populations. One in specifically involved 15,000 people. We have an article that describes it on our website, as well as an article that was published in Explore magazine that we wrote a number of years ago. What we know is that in cell phones within the same brand name, you may have a difference of 600% in terms of energy emissions entering the head. What Carlo showed is that heat transfers from some cell phones, particularly the higher powered devices, penetrates the skull into the brain and slows down the repair of DNA. And it also causes a breakdown in the blood-brain barrier, which allows toxins to get into the brain. And he believes that this is the underlying mechanism for tumor formation. It has a lot to do with dosage, time, and the type of phone that you're using. So all of those factors play into it, as well as whether you're using a speaker phone, one that you hold a foot away from the head, or whether you're using an ear jack. And so when you look at these studies, unless they break down, and I've seen that public press report, but I have not seen the actual study to know whether.
All right, doctor, hold it right there. We're really up against the clock. This is Coast. We'll be right back. Once again, here is Dr. Nick Begich, and doctor, without delay, a lot of people are waiting. Here we go, east of the Rockies. It's Dave in Dearborn, Michigan.
Hi, how you doing? Not to plug a book or anything, but back in the summer, I read Spy Chips, and toward the end of the book, one of the last chapters, they had actually printed a patent application filed with the U.S. Patent Office. Someone had actually filed this for what he called a deep organ implant chip capable of delivering an electric shock by remote for someone who, quote, moved out of their areas, and also that would be able to record and transmit your conversation. This book also stated that the corporations pushing this technology have created a computer program that can create up to 800 million trillion, if I recall this right, unique numbers, kind of like
an unbreakable code. Yeah,
right. And
yeah, I think I've got the idea where you could keep a person in a virtual jail, and if they walk past a certain point, zap, doctor. Dr. Begich?
Look at the United States in terms of the number of people we incarcerate. It's becoming a huge cost and a huge problem. The ankle bracelet for monitoring people in their home is going to be replaced with a microcircuit. The idea of putting you in a virtual electronic cage is what this caller is referring to. I don't think that's too far out. I think maybe it's another decade away, or the right level of fear in the population to allow us to sort of look the other way. That's how fear is used. You know, when you look at the brain, for people experiencing fear, the brain demonstrates very incoherent brain patterns when you're expressing those kinds of emotions, whereas when you're thinking rationally is when your brain is and your emotions are a much more positive nature. You experience empathy, compassion. The positive emotions are the types that lend themselves to good thinking. When you start to look at all of these technologies, fear is what's driving it. Will we see them come about? Absolutely. The patents and the patent records are pretty extensive. If you go and just do searches on the internet under the patent office, you'll find many, many more than just the ones this caller's indicated.
Okay, not a lot of time. Let's go to the international line. It's Bill in British Columbia on with Dr. Begich.
Hi, Art. Hey, good to hear from you again. And I'd like to ask you, first of all, how did you make out with that latest typhoon?
Well, here we got not much more than rain in sheets, a lot of rain and wind. But in the Visayas area south of us, there are many dead. So,
yeah, I know. It wasn't very good. Anyway, it's a little different than Nevada, isn't it?
Just
or
a bit.
Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, I was going to ask the doctor there about the the heart project. I guess, like you, I'm an amateur operator, and I'm a little closer to it. I'm about approximately 100 miles south of the Alaska Panhandle, and observed the effects of the heart project radioactively. And also discussed that with a number of people in Alaska. And for a lot of years, we were trying to figure out what the heck they were doing, what we got was flim flam, flim flam, flim flam. As you know, they never ever told us. What's your opinion, doctor, on what they actually were doing?
Well, I mean, it's pretty clear in the literature. I mean, from our perspective, there's it's electromagnetic radiation, not radioactive in that sense. But electromagnetic radiation is used for, in the case of HARP, focusing radio frequency energy and injecting it into the magnetic field lines of the Earth in certain applications is something they're doing to create. Initially, it was to create a shield for incoming intercontinental ballistic missiles. The idea was that we could pump energy into the magnetic field lines and create a shield around the planet. This is what was eventually originally envisioned, so that anything coming through that field, this electronics would be disrupted and the crafts would crash. When you look at some of the communications applications, some of the weather modification applications, all those things show up within the patent record. Most of that is covered in a series of articles on our website and also in the book, Angels Don't Play This Harp. The web articles are free. Get them, read them, and pass them on to others.
All right, good enough. Let's move, let's go to David in Queens, New York. You're on with Dr. Begich.
How are you, gentlemen, tonight?
Just fine.
Well, you know, mine is basically not a question, but it's just to see if you are in agreement with me. A couple of months back, I was listening to some information from a club called Prophecy Club, and they had mentioned the scalar technology being originated in the Russian government, but they were saying that America really has no power to go against it because of the technology is far advanced. And also, I just truly believe that once you gathered this information, which was really great, that you can tie it to the political stream of our government. And I just believe that they know all what's going on. from us, and that's what makes, you know, the system and the political ties with your senators having information and the currency changes quite a very sticky issue. So I just wanted to know if you was in agreement with that, Doctor, because, you know, America is really being absorbed now, and I just see it as the end of an era.
You know, all these things are connected. What I can say is the scalar technology actually goes back to the very inventions of AC current. Nikola Tesla, this is his 150th anniversary of his birth this year, 2006. But Tesla had I have every paper and every lecture that he ever wrote and was publicly released, and I've reviewed those. And he had noticed the phenomena that he equated as faster than the speed of light, which is supposed to be impossible. But the way in which scalars work, as opposed to vectors, things sort of appear simultaneously everywhere. It would look that way. I think if you really wanted to analyze the literature, Tesla probably was the first discoverer. Although, like many things, Tesla, he unfortunately wasn't recognized until many, many decades after his death. You know, when you look at scalars as an area of technology, all of our instruments are geared for measuring different forms of energy. Scalars aren't part of that. And yet, more and more literature is beginning to express itself and show that perhaps this form of energy might, in fact, be more debilitating than anything else, creating standing waves, creating certain circumstances where human physiology can be dramatically impacted and not appropriately shielded. I think every sophisticated government in the world is researching these technologies. Whoever gets there first in the advent of preemptive war could win the fight. And I think this is, again, why a lot more discussion about these directions needs to be had, both in this country and internationally.
All right. Wild card line one, I think it's Carl in Spokane, Washington. You're on the air with Dr. Begich.
Hi there, Dr. Begich.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing good.
I would like to ask you if you are familiar with a network where citizens can be put on it and they're monitored, their every move is monitored. And also, have you heard of anything that allows them to actually read people's mind? There's been a lot of discussion about that.
Actually, that's a couple of great questions. In terms of monitoring movements of people through implant technologies, we kind of covered that a little bit in terms of military personnel. Some governments were actually implementing this. You know, when you think about how small these circuits are going to be, you could actually inject them with a vaccine. So, you know, the question becomes is would they, could they? And the answer is yes, they could. Would they is another matter, and one day we may see the answer to that. When you're talking about all of these technologies, the fact is they are here today. It's only a question of who will be the instigator and what excuse will be used to do it. There was another part to that question, and I just spaced it. Art, can you help me with that?
No, I can't.
Okay.
Sorry
about that, caller. There was another part to this, and I know I just totally blew it and missed it.
Well, then, so did I. Sorry. Tim, Alberta, Canada, with Dr. Nick Begich.
Season greetings, gentlemen.
Thank you.
That time of year. My question is about tracking. Just before, if you can give me just 1 second, Art, when we went to commercial break, you said you're in the Philippines now. You said ocean to ocean to ocean to ocean to ocean, right?
Coast to coast, across oceans, yeah.
Yeah, all of them. Tonight, there's a 25-year-old girl that's bobbing in the Atlantic Ocean. You've probably seen it on CNN, possibly. She came off one of those training sailboats late Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And she's right at the very end of her survivability. So if there is a Christmas miracle like we got 10 years ago by finding that missing Learjet that turned up, just shortly after the show? Remember that? That was probably close to 10 years. Then I'm asking for another one. So, but anyways, to get back to the tracking issue, a lot of people probably don't know, but China is launching 3 of their first GPS satellites very shortly. And with 3, they're going to map their country and a couple of surrounding countries, like probably Art, where he's at. But within a short period of time, they're going to have a complete array up. So they'll have the same capability that the United States has for GPS coverage of the whole world.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm wondering, China, you know, everything's made in China now. I mean, the greatest population. And these chips, RF chips, cell phone components, is all coming out of China, you know. possibly these chips that we're talking about tonight, can you see, when it comes to the actual tracking, the satellite tracking themselves, are they, is China, are they going to have an upper hand on us?
You know, the fact is, I think, again, when you look at these microcircuits, you know, when our technology is exported off and we build in back doors so you can access that technology through, you know, for our national security reasons, I'm sure China applies the same basic principles. I mean, these are, you have the ability to do it. Why wouldn't you? In fact, China, when you look at the amount they spend on military, you know, it's always downplayed because it's only 10% of what we spend. But go to China and see what a dollar gets you. I mean, when we started the show, I remember Art was talking about a pack of cigarettes being 37 pesos,
That's right.
which is less than a buck. You know, when you go to China and you go buy labor, top scientists might cost you a couple thousand a month at the most. Here in the United States, it might cost you 10 or 20,000 a month for that same mm-hmm. level of expertise. And I would suggest out of over a billion people in China, the level of science that you can develop in a centralized economy, you bring those scientists into a closer and closer form, and the absolute best minds work for government. Information warfare is the warfare of the 21st century, and that includes penetrating every information system on the planet. The Chinese are not ignoring that. In fact, what has been published by the United States Senate in terms of defense intelligence that has been released tell us exactly that this is, in fact, one of the major areas of science and development and military science all over the world, particularly in China.
All right. First-time caller line, it's Jim in Houston, Texas, for Dr. Bigich.
Hi. So pleased to be on with you. Art, I've been listening to you for years. And anyway,
I guess we've got a two-way radio going on in the background there.
It's off. Had to respond to your talk about the founders when they were faced with the threat from pirates. They sent our Marines over to the shores of Tripoli, and I believe they would be totally in favor of defending our country against terrorism the way it's being done.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I don't agree with that. I think we've gone too far. Every time that we get a revelation about what is being done, people do get upset about it. I mean, there is a balancing act, and that balancing act, I think, has gone the wrong direction too far. The threat is a real threat. If we're going to attack that threat in a credible way, let's not give up our democracy to do it. If we have to do that, then we lost this war. And
there are two ways to lose, and one of them, Dr. Bigich, is just directly losing by some horrible terrorist act. And the other, of course, is overreacting to terrorism in such a way that we destroy that which we were trying to protect.
Exactly. And, you know, what we're receiving is what's called blowback in the intelligence community. It's because of all of the activities we've been engaged in, it's now coming back in a way that is quite dramatic. And we have to defend the country. We have to do the things that are necessary to prevent terrorist acts. Terrorists are very sophisticated in what they're doing, and yet we're able to nail a lot of them with the kind of intelligence that's happening, not just with our own government, but governments around the world that are cooperating. It's not just our freedoms that are being threatened. It's all free people in the world are being threatened. And I think that coordination and cooperation is essential and important, but how we balance it, we cannot give everything up. Then what have we preserved?
Absolutely nothing. Sherry in Phoenix, Arizona, you're on with Dr. Bigich.
Dr. Bigich, I just wanted to tell you, thank heavens you're doing the work you're doing, in spite of what that previous caller said. I'm certainly appreciative. As a victim myself of the testing of this technology since about 1992, I just wanted to ask you if there are any types of protective measures that a person can take at all. I found just little things. For example, I no longer sleep on a bed that has metal springs in it, and, you know, just things like that. But I'm just wondering if you know of any other little things that we might do to protect ourselves. I mean, I have black and blue marks on my body, and I have broken blood vessels all over my body from where this technology has been used on me.
You know,
any suggestions?
At the present time, we do not have anything on countermeasures. We are working on it. We are not ignoring it. But what we're not going to do is suggest things that we don't believe are going to be effective. or speculate on what is effective. There's over 500,000 victims of human experimentation in this country of every kind and shape, according to our government's own admissions. What we really think needs to happen is a congressional inquiry, open disclosures, and remediation from those for those Americans that have been so victimized. Because it is an unfair circumstance. I don't know your particular situation, but I can tell you, you are not alone. And the fact is, we need to continue in a vigilant approach to fair disclosure, and let's make sure American citizens within this country are protected from the abuses of their government.
All right, let's go east of the Rockies. Michelle in Albany, New York, with Dr. Begich.
Hello. I've been wanting to ask this question for quite some time, but it seems like no matter where I'm at, whether it's from city to city, town to town, and I just moved from California to New York, I hear outside and almost feel this low, deep, bassy-sounding, pulsating, intermittent noise, but anybody else I ask if they can hear it, they can't. Is it power lines? Do you happen to know what it is?
You're hearing what is referred to often as the Taos hum or the Kokomo hum. It's also heard in many places around the world. Great Britain has 500 cases reported annually. There was a congressman from New Mexico in conjunction with Los Alamos Labs and one of the other major labs went out and analyzed this and found that 1 to 3% of the population hear this low rumbling diesel sound. They did not identify a source, but they said it was a coherent signal, which means it was not natural. It is man-made. But I don't know that we had the I think we had the fox in the hen house making the inspection. So we probably
need
to hear
from an
independent source.
We're out of time. Buddy, that's it. It has been my pleasure to have you on the air, obviously. We will do it again. You have a very good night, and again, thanks for appearing.
Hey, thanks for having me. My best to everyone this holiday season.
Take care, doctor.
Take care.
Bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of, for me, what I call my three-day weekend. I'll have some additional days, I believe, as we move into the holiday season. We'll be doing the traditional predictions, of course, for the year coming. But for this night, for this weekend, I'm Art Bell from Manila, the Philippines. Night, all.